Welcome back to the National Links Trust podcast. This is the second in a series of episodes from the 2023 Symposium on Municipal Golf. In this episode, you'll be listening to a recording of the Municipal Golf Governance and Management Panel. Rachel Carter from the NGCOA moderates the discussion and is joined by Steve Leary, Michael Raby, and Daryl Crawford. Steve, Michael, and Daryl come from different backgrounds in the municipal golf space, but all are great examples of best practices within the industry. Thanks to them for coming to the symposium and sharing their experiences. Let's get right into the discussion.
All right. Well, good afternoon, and thank you for being here today. It's always fun to come together with men and women who are curious about the industry, about the business, about the game. And I congratulate all of you for spending the next 2 days committed to networking and growing your mind. So I'm happy to be part of this. Today, for our panel discussion, we're going to be discussing the different golf management structures, how to navigate the bureaucracy in municipal golf courses with regard specifically to large-scale capital projects, and some best practices for developing key stakeholder relationships. And I'd like to introduce my esteemed panel here. Thank you, gentlemen, for the time to prepare for today and for Andrew for introducing all of us. I've got Michael Raby here from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Mike's a 30-year PGA master professional. He's currently entering his 10th year as director of golf for 5 golf courses operated by the Regional Park District in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And before that, he was with the Cleveland Metro Parks for 16 years after initially getting in the golf business at City Park Golf Course in New Orleans. An interesting fact I've learned about Mike while we've been working together to prepare for this afternoon is that he is also the vice chairman of the PGA of America Rules of Golf Committee. So beware if you get paired with him in the golf outing this week. In that capacity, he teaches the PGA USGA Rules of Golf workshops and has officiated at multiple major tournaments, including the PGA Championships, the Ryder Cup, the Masters, the European Tour BMW Masters, and the recent Tokyo Olympics. You've got a good Instagram account, so you can follow him on Instagram. He posts as he goes to the different tournaments, so that's a lot of fun. So thank you for being here today. Next to him, we have Daryl Crawford, General Manager of Papago Golf Course. And it is you, not your twin brother today, right? Daryl has interesting facts. He has a twin, identical twin brother. Daryl was bitten early by the golf bug and grew up playing in Encanto and Maryville golf courses in Phoenix, where he also eventually played collegiate golf for Phoenix College and Arizona State University. He's worked in golf operations. I counted it up for over 40 years. Sorry, put you on blast, but including facilities such as Orange Tree Golf Club, Alta Mesa Country Club, Stone Creek Legacy Golf Club, and ASU Karsten Golf Course, which at the time was home to the Arizona State Sun Devil men's and women's golf programs. You'll learn more about how that evolves during our conversations. And in between, you had some several years with Ping in some interesting roles. I was very envious of the one where you were a liaison with the European and American product teams in marketing. So grab a drink with Daryl. He'll probably have some great stories later. He's currently the general manager and director of golf at ASU's new home course, Papago Golf Club. We're going to hear more about that. And recently, I wanted to recognize you and congratulate you on stage because you are a recent recipient of the Dr. Ed Updegraff Award, which is Arizona Golf Association's highest honor. So congratulations. And we have Mr. Stephen Leary, former mayor of Winter Park. Stephen's been a lot of fun also to get to know. He resides in Winter Park, Florida, hangs out with some golf royalty, I've learned, between Matt Ginella and some others, right? That he has a lot of fun. And co-owns and operates 2 privately held companies. But really what we invited you here today is to share with us some of your experience when you were elected Winter Park mayor in 2015 and then reelected in 2018 and oversaw the renovation of Winter Park 9. So we look forward to hearing your stories about that. Thank you for being here. And again, my name is Rachel Carter. I'm with the National Golf Course Owners Association. The NGCOA is the only trade association truly exclusively dedicated to golf course owners and operators. And I know that in that New York Times bestselling author, Tom Coyne, being a new golf course owner. We will talk later. So our members include owners, operators, general managers of daily fee, municipal, semi-private, private, and resort courses of all sizes. And our mission is to provide information and inspiration on how to operate golf courses as efficiently and profitably as possible. So that's what we do. Thank you very much to Andrew and the team at National Links Trust for inviting me to be here today. I love being in DC. We were here not too long ago for National Golf Day and are already in preparation for the spring National Golf Day again in 2024. So to get started, I want to set the stage for the audience by understanding the management model at each of your properties, because you're a little bit different. And municipalities have a variety of management options when it comes to operating a golf course. And so I wanted you to just share with us a little bit, what is the model at your property? We can start with you, Michael, and how is that working?
Working very well. And real quick, at the beginning of this, at the introduction, someone said something about listening to experts. Well, with the PGA and USGA Rules of Golf workshops that I teach, every year there's an expert workshop. And to attend the expert workshop, you have to have scored really high on the test before. And I've taught the last couple expert workshops. I like to hit our expert class with a quote at the beginning of the workshop from my favorite physicist, Niels Bohr, who said, "An expert is someone who's made every mistake possible in a very narrow area of study." And based on that, I feel fully qualified to be here. And hearkening back to rough height, a golf ball, 1.68 inches, the rough should never be higher than this. That's as high, you know, to me, rough is grass that is higher than the fairway. So I like, you know, for municipal golf courses, I see a lot of average golfers. They're not hitting down really well on the ball. They like to scoop it. So if you're going to err on your fairways, make them a little high. If you're going to err on your roughs, make them a little low. I don't want them walking in circles out in that rough looking for a golf ball all day. That's not called a good golf experience. So, all right, government structures. The park district that I work for right now is Breck in Baton Rouge. Now, BREC is kind of an acronym. It's really, the proper name is the Recreation and Park Commission for the Parish of East Baton Rouge. Now, in a very southern way, they've just taken Baton Rouge and recreation and kind of slurred them all together into the acronym BREC, and that's what it is. But really, interestingly, BREC is an independent governmental agency with its charter from the state legislature, with a taxing and service district of East Baton Rouge Parish. It is not the city, it is not the county, it is not the parish, it's not the state, it's not federal, it is a regional independent park district. While that is unusual, it's not that unusual because it's really the same as Cleveland Metro Parks in Cleveland, Ohio. Exact same setup, and I think Hamilton County in Cincinnati has something similar to that. And, you know, you really don't get to pick your government structure, but if you do, this is a good one because you're not, you know, your budget is competing for money with parks. It's, Breck doesn't just do golf, you know, it has 180 parks and a zoo and a bunch of nature centers, a whole bunch of rec centers, and it really does parks and recreation. And having golf part of that, you know, we are next year will be 6.5 million out of the whole agency's budget of around 110 million. But I'm not part of a city where you have to fight for budget money around competing with emergency services or someone like that, that residents might see as more important. One kind of downside to this structure is everywhere that I know that has this structure, cities have, I think, generally guaranteed income coming from taxes. Although this structure has a tax base, the tax levy is a 10-year levy that has to be renewed every 10 years. But generally, when I was with Cleveland Metro Parks, we would renew our tax levies with positive over 70% yes on the renewal. And the last time Breck went out for a renewal, they got it renewed with over 60%. So it is a it's a fairly safe way to go as far as operating within a government structure.
Great, thank you. Daryl, how about you at Papago?
Much more simplistic. So Papago is a City of Phoenix asset that has been operated through the city in 1963. Our the new setup is the City of Phoenix has a lease agreement with Arizona State University. And then there is a separate foundation in place called the Arizona Golf Community Foundation, which has a relationship with ASU. So the golf course itself now is not funded by the university or funded by the city. So private donations, partners in the community, and operating our business very efficiently and positively has allowed us to do the things that we like to do. So it's a Billy Bell property designed, hosted major championships, the USGA 1971 Public Links Championship, 2008 LPGA event as well. So a very well-known product in the Valley.
Thank you. Steve, I wanted you to talk about something in particular. You know, we represent about 400 municipal golf properties at the NGCOA that are members of ours. And some of the conversations I've heard is that there can be a disconnect sometimes between maybe the operator and the city parks director. That sometimes the language isn't always, you know, one maybe wants to talk revenue and one wants to talk rounds, or they just sometimes have a difficult time communicating. What was the structure at Winter Park, and how did you guys operate successfully when it comes to the management structure?
Good afternoon, everyone. We had, at the time when we started talking about renovating the course, the Parks Department oversaw the golf course. But we quickly realized that if we're going to attract talent, if we were going to allow these folks to do what they needed to do to renovate that course and keep it running, we kind of had to separate it out. So we had the course superintendent, course director, report directly into the assistant city manager. There's some egos attached with a lot of this. When you tell the parks director that the guy that's going to be reporting him is probably going to be the most recognizable person on a city property, there's some ego involved with that. Our parks director didn't last too much longer after this reorganization, surprisingly. We have now the course director reporting directly into the assistant city manager. The salary wages are a little bit different. We pulled all of the folks out that were not only cutting the golf course and maintaining the golf course, but they were also doing the same thing for the lacrosse fields and soccer fields. They're solely dedicated to the golf course, and it's worked out really well. We've kind of created a little bit of a, you know, an elite squad, if you will. And there's much more pride. These guys are in there Saturdays and Sundays. They stop by. They're getting recruited now by local courses, local private courses that are paying them a heck of a lot more. But these guys really have taken ownership in the course. So it's worked out really well for us.
Thank you, gentlemen. You know, salaries come up a couple of times, and I can't help myself but share with you that the NGCOA just released our 2024 Golf Industry Compensation and Benefits Study. And if you're in operations, that's a great tool that you can use when it comes to making sure that you're falling within competitive wage and benefit offerings. So one of the commonalities that we uncovered early on when we were preparing for today is the experience that all of you have as it relates to large-scale capital improvement projects. And that's a theme that we talked about architecture, and that will continue over the next day and a half. So I'd like to turn our attention there. You each have some very interesting insight and experience on this topic. And Andrew, if you want to go to the second or third slide there, I just wanted to share with you that the NGCOA is also releasing our golf business pulse report and a couple sneak peek previews into that as it relates to capital improvement projects. The 85% of our facility owners, when reporting on submitting their information for this year's study, say that their expenditures are up on capital improvements. I don't think that's a surprise. We've seen that being in the industry. Timetables for the approval have also improved. as only 10% say that the timetables have been delayed. And while that still seems negative, that is actually down from 28% who indicated delays in our previous study. And from a municipal facility standpoint, this would imply to us that there's a need for speed, so to speak, as we're seeing profitability rise at our facilities, that we want to invest in them quicker for quicker turnaround. So I'm curious, before we move on, I've tried to make my way through the room, but how many of you are in operations, just by a raise of your hands, so we kind of know who we're speaking to? Okay. Okay, great. Have any of you recently completed a capital improvement project? Okay, and anybody getting ready to start one? Okay, good. All right. So that's who your audience is. We've got some good advice for you. So municipal golf courses often face several challenges. You can go to the next slide, Andrew, when it comes to capital improvements. And so we cherry picked a few to kind of go through today, and those being funding, stakeholder engagement, competitive pressures, timelines, and then balancing the needs of the community. So let's start with funding. Securing adequate funding for capital improvements can be a major hurdle, particularly with a municipal property. So generally, you're relying on government grants. We talked earlier, was brought up the public-private partnership. And Daryl, you've got a really good story for how you fundraised at Papago. Will you share that with us and how that partnership really has paid off for you?
Thanks, Rachel. So certainly well above my pay grade, the individuals that were involved in getting Papago to a new place where it is today. And by the way, we are a Troon managed golf facility as well. Greg Trias is a gentleman that's been in the Valley for quite some time and a very respected individual. He heads the foundation part of it. You know, we're very fortunate to live in a golf mecca in the Phoenix metropolitan Scottsdale area and the state. So there's a lot of golf coming into the Valley. It's a $6 billion industry, economic industry that comes in. So there certainly are individuals that we could, at least Greg could count on to help support. And so one of those individuals was the Lou Grubb Foundation, which helped us in a huge way because they funded a new clubhouse for the property. And it was about a $14 million project between the clubhouse and then the event pavilion, which allowed us to set ourselves in a different place. The other part of it that was part of that funding was for a renovation that we did last summer. So again, the Lou Grubb Foundation, certainly issues involved in their playing their role in it. And the two entities certainly have allowed us to get to bring Papago to a place where people see it as more of a destination than what may be described as just a muni golf course.
Yeah, when we were talking and I was learning about this partnership, one of the key takeaways that you wanted to make sure that the people with us today was to look in your own community, right?
Absolutely.
For somebody that can help.
Yeah, look in your own community. I think as I said, we're very fortunate to live in a golf mecca. And so that's somewhat of a unique environment there. And certainly we feel like there's a lot of people that can be drawn into to see the value of creating something that's special at a place like Papago, and to make sure that you're doing your due diligence, that's out there finding individuals or programs themselves, grant programs that would create a value for you as well.
Great. Mike, you have a little bit of a different story when we talked about how you have funded and will fund some of your projects. Can you share a little bit about that?
Sure. We are on a 10-year levy cycle. And within that 10-year levy, there is a certain amount of money set aside for golf. We have five golf courses. I didn't go into that before. We have three 18-hole golf courses and two 9-hole golf courses and a couple driving ranges. In the last 10-year levy cycle, we had $2.2 million set aside for capital projects, which might sound like a nice amount until you try to do a substantial portion of an irrigation system, and then that's it for your 10 years. Thank you very much. But We also, the park district that we're part of, decided to do a larger project of renovating a zoo and the park that the zoo is in. But we, that same park, we had two golf courses in that park. One is a 9-hole historic golf course, and the other is an 18-hole golf course that really wasn't very good. The 9-hole golf course was losing $75,000 to $100,000 a year. The 18-hole golf course was losing $300,000 to $500,000 a year. So out of the $50 million set aside for this zoo and parks improvement project, we managed to get $2 million of that to improve the 9-hole golf course. We took the 9-hole golf course from a 2,000-yard 9-hole golf course to a 3,200-yard 9-hole par 36 9-hole golf course that reopened earlier this year. When we reopened the 9-hole golf course, we closed the 18-hole golf course that had been hemorrhaging money for many years. That's a course that would not have survived if it hadn't been supported by government money. But that was really a case of there being a compelling need to do something to address some other issues. Where those improvements were going on were in the same park as one of our golf courses, and we were able to get some of that money to put it into one of our really a historic 9-hole golf course. That golf course is J.S. Clark Golf Course. It's in Baton Rouge. It was the first golf course built in Louisiana for Black golfers. It was in the early 1950s at a time where in the Baton Rouge area, Black golfers could not play on most of the public golf courses. So that golf course is recently renovated, and it came out wonderfully. There is a bit of a cautionary story that I think we should probably go into a little bit. And it goes back to, you know, our architects talked about RFPs. And I've talked with some other people in the room about how to approach these bigger projects. And I know we were talking about how to get the money. This is more about how to spend the money. We had $2.2 million to spend on a 9-hole golf course, but it was part of a $50 million project. So, of course, we're government, and we did an RFP, and they hired a parks consulting company that does all this national parks consulting, and they were hired to manage the whole big project. So then they hire a construction company to do all the renovation at the zoo and all the renovation in the park. Well, then the construction company hires a golf course construction company. Then the golf course construction company, you know, hires someone to do the irrigation and someone else to do the cart paths. And, you know, when you look at all the levels where someone had to take out a slice of profits, I think we got, you know, a $1.4 or $5 million renovation for our $2.2 million. I wouldn't think that that was the most efficient process possible. Now, on the other side of the ledger, where I previously was with Cleveland Metro Parks, they take a much more entrepreneurial approach to it, to doing projects like this. Right as I was leaving there in 2014, they were undertaking a project of replacing the irrigation system at one of their golf courses. They decided to do it in-house. They bought all the materials and renovated their irrigation system in-house. And I've heard it wasn't perfect. And, you know, they had one hole closed at a time as they worked their way around the golf course over the course of a year. But they didn't close the golf course, and they did it in-house, and they probably did it for less money. They are, in fact, ramping up right now to do that again at another one of their golf courses next year. I think they're intending to replace multiple irrigation systems. I worked from Cleveland Metro Parks from 98 to 2014. When I went there in 98, they had 6 courses. When I left, they had 8 courses. So they have a bunch of courses, and they've decided they have multiple irrigation systems that need to be worked on. So they're really going out, and they purchase some equipment that you need to do the work. And, you know, we recently got a quote for replacing the entire irrigation system at our Santa Maria golf course in Baton Rouge. And depending on what all got replaced, it was between $2.2 and $2.7 million. I know right now Cleveland Metro Parks just bought around $250,000 worth of equipment, tractor and other equipment used for irrigation. And they're buying the raw material for the irrigation system, all of the pipe, all the heads, all the connectors in bulk for around $700,000. And they're intending to do another one in-house next year. So it's not, there's a lot of different ways to do it. And when we talk, I like this panel because we have very different experiences. It's hard sometimes to talk about municipal golf because there's different structures. And there's also, what we talked about earlier, when I picture talking about municipal golf, it's like you took a table and you put 1,000 Rubik's cubes on them and they're all mixed up differently. Well, there's a solution for each Rubik's cube, but they're not the same pathway to get there. And there are certain moves you do to solve a Rubik's cube, and what one course needs might be similar. It's an interesting analogy, just that the things that we do to get these courses where we want them are often similar, but what needs to be done and how much and in what order, it's all a unique solution.
Absolutely. And that leads us into, Steve, your experience at Winter Park was different. When we talked earlier about the panel talked about the RFP process, and Mike brought it up again. Share with us, your approach is a little unconventional, I think, and share with us how that process went.
To take one quick step back, when the possibility of renovating the course came up, I asked the city manager to kind of share the books with me. Now, I'm not a full-time politician. That was a part-time gig that I had, so I have a much more business background. And he said, we're about to invest $750,000 to renovate the course, and we're losing $250,000 a year. And I just said, that doesn't make any sense, that math. So that's when we kind of started taking a deeper look at renovating the entire course and what would that take. So when we found our budget, we went out through the RFP process. What I had done previous to that was speak to a bunch of folks who were in the golf profession. There's a couple guys from the Golf Channel. There are some folks, there are some names you would know that all kind of lived around the area, given the Golf Channel being in the area and some other developers who had developed courses along with their hotels. And so they were kind of the passion behind the RFP. They were the ones, and I used them, we used them to really drive this thing forward. So it wasn't a politician, elected official drive. And what they said was, you'd be crazy to try and parcel out irrigation and parcel out sod and parcel out all the other aspects of it, the shapers. You need to do it through a design build process. And Mike and I had a conversation just a few moments ago, because I remember 2 years ago, I think it was about 2 years ago, right, Mike, that we met to discuss the project that he was trying to get through the pipeline up in near Hoopy. And it worked out really well for us. It did not become the mayor's project. It was really the people, the population, it was really the stakeholders in the area who were pushing this process through. So that's, we were really successful in doing it. As I said, and just some quick numbers, if you guys want to take numbers to anybody that you're interested in showing that it can work. In 2015, before we started this, the first full year, that the last full year of the old guard, we were revenue of $400,000, losing $250,000 a year. We had 34,000 rounds, and we were getting $253,000 a year in fees and $32,000 a year in memberships. Last year, 2022, we did $1.2 million in total revenue. We're going to make about $700,000 to $800,000 off of that. We're playing 43,000 rounds versus 34,000. Our fees were at $700,000 off of up from 253, and our membership, where we were making $32,000 a year, we're $230,000 a year. So if you need numbers to back up what a course can do for a community and what a course can do for a budget, they're there.
See, did you have any resistance from the current users when you were proposing a renovation? Because I've seen that, where I know when I was in Cleveland, the Metro Parks took over Seneca Golf Course, and there were some users there that it was a city-owned golf course that they gave away to Cleveland Metro Parks because they weren't, it was losing them money. And the current user said, well, you guys, you know, you're going to improve it. And then when you improve it, you're going to raise the rates. And because it's nicer, more people are going to come out here, and we'd rather have lower rates and have it to ourselves. You know, so I think that resistance from current users can be something you have to overcome to go into a renovation like that.
Will hosted a panel where we had this exact discussion, and the new course manager called me and he said, I keep getting these calls that the guys who play this course every day aren't going to come back because we're raising the rates from $14 to $16. And he said, what do I tell him? And I said, bye-bye. And he said, you might get some calls. And I said, tell them to call me. If people are leaving for $2, those are not the people we want to play. I just read you the numbers. The numbers don't lie. We have a waiting list for membership. We had people complaining about $2, and guess what? Those guys are all back. They're not buying annual memberships now, and they're the biggest advocates for the course. Stick with what you know. We're talking about the timing it takes to do this too. We shut down in March. We're back open in October. We ripped the Band-Aid off. We did it all quickly. If we did it, especially in politics, if we did it hole by hole, 3 holes at a time, 6 holes at a time, 1 year versus the next year, you get new people who are going to get elected, who are going to come in and change things. Just get it done, bite the bullet, get it done. And as I said, it was a part-time gig for me. If they didn't elect me back, I got other things to do. I got 18-year-old triplets, man. I am ready to go home. So I was happy to term out.
Girl triplets, right?
I have 2 boys and a girl.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
If I could just, Darryl, please. Just want to add one thing. I totally agree in terms of that. You know, Papago is a place like many municipal golf courses that, as I heard earlier on the panel, where golf goes from generation to generation. And a lot of the individuals that play municipal golf don't like change. And $14 to $16 is change. Pocket change. Papago existed in a double wide trailer for 10 years prior to getting the Lou Grubb Clubhouse privately funded through the Lou Grubb Foundation, which was made the biggest difference it could possibly make in getting us to into a new place. And there were several people that played the course that I don't need a clubhouse. I liked where the rate is. You don't need to change the golf course. You don't need to do anything. You're always going to fight that. But I agree with those same thing happened for us. Those individuals came back, said they were never going to play at Papago again. And we're fortunate to have a structure that has if you live in the Maricopa County, you can buy a city card, you get a great rate throughout. And so having the ability, as the panel was talking about earlier, from a design perspective, talked about having individuals who don't live in that Maricopa County area who are coming into town that are providing money for that into that $6 billion economic impact. You need those individuals so that you can self-fund things you need to do in the future, which is what we're trying to do and have done in order to continue to make the product better and better and better.
Hey everyone, sorry to interrupt real quick. Just wanted to tell you about ShopNLT.com. ShopNLT.com is National Links Trust's online store that features apparel and accessories that support our mission to positively impact local communities through municipal golf. From November 21st through 27th, we'll also be running our annual holiday sale, so be sure to head over there to give the gift of NLT this holiday season. Now let's get back to the episode.
Darryl, you guys, speaking of some of those generational men's and women's golf groups, when you were preparing to open, share with the group how you really helped brought them into the fold and let them feel part of the process.
Absolutely. So there's a very strong presence. There's a men's club and a ladies club that have been involved for quite some time. Obviously, you know, the individuals that have lived in the Valley have been playing Papago, which has been a Valley favorite again since 1963. So one of the, certainly the first things we did was to make sure that we were communicating what the plan was and showing individuals drawings of what the new clubhouse was going to look like and how it was going to help create a more community impact for the golf course. So they were involved up front because from our perspective, the it was important that those two entities, those groups that had seen change up and down over the last, you know, several decades of the property to be a part of what was going to be a really positive change. So making sure that we were chatting with them about it, making sure they saw those renderings, invited to invitations to talk about where we were going and how long it was going to take. That was so important because in order for us to be successful, we need those individuals that are part of those clubs to be saying great things outside when they leave Papago to wherever they're going to play. We have a lot of members, especially in the ladies clubs, that are members at private clubs as well as being a part of the organization. So that was extremely key.
Yeah, these are great best practices for engaging your stakeholders. And Steve, I want to go back to you in regards to WP9, because I'm looking forward to hopefully visiting the property and the community next month. But from what I know about it, I can just imagine the disruption that moving this dirt and in the middle of, because it's located in a highly trafficked area, right, of your little downtown area. I love the stories, if you could share with the rest of the group, of how you managed the residents' buy-in and some of the interactions that took place between the builder and the community.
Yeah, there's a lot of stakeholders in this. There's employees. I mean, our staff were stakeholders in this. Our residents, this is right in the heart of our downtown. People get off of Sunrail train, they walk right to the course. So the shapers, the architects were the shapers. I drove by one day and Keith Reb was off dozer talking to a nice lady that was pushing her granddaughter in her stroller. And I pulled up and, you know, half of me wants to say, get the hell back on the dozer. And then the other half was just so thrilled that he was out there talking to members of our community who are now looking at this thing. It was not fenced in. It was all wide open. People were seeing everything every day. Our staff members, we had them rather than furloughing them while we went through this entire process. We actually had Keith engage them. So they worked the course to not only understand how to maintain it, but understand the theory behind some of the things, how they cut the tee box and why they shape the tee box the way they shape the tee box. So it was important for us to get their buy-in as well. And then again, the golfers. The most important thing I think Keith and Riley did when they came to the course was they said, we understand this is a park first. Winter Park is very proud of our parks. We have more parks per square per resident than almost any city in the country of our size. And so Keith, that's the way they sold it through to the community. And then again, the golfers came out and we had, you know, there's some, again, pretty high profile golfers who live in and around Winter Park who are visiting this thing, checking it out. And when word got out that those guys were, you know, these guys won Masters, they've won British Opens, and they're driving by commenting on it publicly. So then other golfers came and started talking about it. This course, you still see today a father and son walking the course, a husband and wife walking the course. I have seen grandparents pushing grandchildren in strollers why husbands and wives play the course. So it's really kind of pulled in the entire community. And it's, that's an easy sell through to a commission too.
I love the story of the nanny. I have to admit there was one sort of very important stakeholder that I wasn't thinking of when we were talking about stakeholder engagement, but And that was a superintendent that Keith pulled in. It was your staff, right? Was he a superintendent with your parks department at some point?
He was.
And really pulled him into the process. And I thought that that was really intelligent and helps for a sustainable process to have the person who was going to be taking care of the property part of the renovation. So can you share with us how that evolved?
Yeah, that was a conversation. It kind of came out of the, what are we going to do with staff? We don't want to lay off staff or furlough them for 6 months. And so Ed became part of the team. And I think I was the guy that lost out immensely on all this because I had to keep contact with these guys and keep them going too. I went through more bourbon every week feeding these guys. But it was good because I wanted them to know too that the city was bought into this and senior level city was bought into this. But it was important because Ed, who was our maintenance supervisor at the time, he was out there all day long with these guys, working machinery he'd never worked before. And again, it ended up, Ed left for the Country Club of Orlando to become their superintendent of their course, which is a huge pay increase for Ed. And it all came about because of the notoriety that he got from the Winter Park Nine. I mean, he owned that course. He was out there. I'd see him on Sundays, 7 o'clock in the morning, just coming in to check up on things. So pulling city staff into it was incredibly important for us.
Okay, we're going to shift gears and talk a little bit about timelines. And I was laughing because Troy in the previous panel mentioned a multi-year RFP process with the city of Charleston. As it relates to timelines, and there's a few, as you saw, that are getting ready to embark on a project. What advice might you have for anybody in the room who finds himself preparing or maybe even in the middle of a process like this?
You already heard, I didn't care if I got reelected, so I just pushed this thing through. I think in one way, we were very fortunate because none of the other members of the commission were really big golfers. So they kind of I don't consider myself a major golfer, but I knew the process and I knew enough to keep people out of their way. And that was my goal in this entire thing was let's get the process out of the process's way. And so our RFP was very quickly. It was very quick. And we didn't pull things apart on the RFP. It was a design build and let's move forward. We decided very early on to just make this thing happen. You get one more commissioner who comes in who's new and you got to bring them up to speed. You're going to start the whole RFP process again. So make it happen as quickly as you can and have an advocate on the commission, have advocates in the community to drive it forward so it's not looking like it's a political thing. It was never my project. It was, these five folks who kind of came forward and led it. So I was kind of their internal champion and I could get things moved out of the way for them. But when you have an outside body from the community coming in, pushing this forward, it takes we talked about taking the emotion out of trees. It took the emotion out of the process.
And for us at Papago, so we weren't renovating the golf course as that had happened several years ago prior to this public-private partnership. So our deal was the clubhouse. And so there wasn't an RFP. We already had decided upon an architect who had done some great work in the Valley. We already had a concept of what we wanted the building to look like and the feel and what it was going to draw. And once we got the contractor in place, things work pretty smoothly, but there's always going to be challenges. There's always going to be issues that you have, and things just take longer. That's just the way that it is. You can't get product or maybe people or equipment or what you thought was going to happen when get to an area of where you're going to be building and the ground is much harder than you thought it was going to be, and there was going to take more equipment and much, much longer to get the site to a place where you can start building on it.
Daryl, you shared with me that you always need to have a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C. You have a recent experience that you shared.
Yeah, so as I said, we had the clubhouse renovation, which took place 6 years ago. But last summer, we did a renovation on the golf course, redid all the bunkers. That was a lot of fun. Moved three greens and three fairways, added some more golf cart paths. And we were the plan that we had was to do it during the summer from basically June through September, knowing that we were going to be overseeding in basically mid-October. And as you just said, Rachel, the plan A, plan B, and as I said, things take a lot longer. Getting sand, getting people, getting equipment, sprigs, you name it. It was never on the timeline that we had in place. And so eventually we had to move our overseeding back 2 weeks because we couldn't get the holes grown in the way we wanted to have them grown in, which impacted some golf tournaments that we had to move to the following year or to a different date, or we ended up losing some of those events. But that's what happens. And even the best laid plans, it's the nature of our business today, in because a lot of people are doing a lot of different things, and it's just difficult to make things sequence out the way you want to sequence out.
And then, Mike, you have a very different approach than the Stephen sort of rip the Band-Aid off, let's close and get this done. Share with us sort of how you've done.
I think it depends on the size of the project and the scope of what you're trying to accomplish. You know, I like the rip the Band-Aid off if you can get it to work, but I also like a slow and steady wins the race type approach, because the weakness of the rip it off, I think, is that for some period of time, you're closed. And for some period of time, your customer is playing golf somewhere else. And I can tell you there's a golf course in my market that closed in February this year and just reopened a couple of weeks ago. And their golfers are playing at my golf courses all summer long. And I can tell you, I talked to a bunch of them who liked it. And I don't know if they're going back. I think some of them will go back. But I, you know, to some degree, I don't want my golfer going to play golf anywhere else if I can avoid it. And you know, one example, we have a 9-hole golf course. The one that's closest to downtown Baton Rouge is called City Park Golf Course. It's right by the City Park Lakes. It's on a beautiful plot of grass down there. But it has, you know, this is literally built in the 1920s, I think 1925, push-up greens, Tiff Dwarf Bermuda on the putting greens. We had some herbicide-resistant goose grass that has gotten into that grass on the putting greens. And we were trying a lot of different things on it, but one strategy was we should regrass to one of the newer ultra dwarfs that grows thicker, where it'll be harder for the goose grass to get in. And, you know, do we hold that off as a bigger project and try to do it all at once? Well, we did 4 of the greens this summer, just out of our operating budget, where in May we closed 2 of them, did very nice temporary greens and put real effort into the temporary greens so we could keep those holes open for play. Killed and stripped 2 greens, and it took off about the top 3 or 4 inches of our subsurface there, replaced that, added drainage to the greens that didn't have it, sprigged them the second to last week of May, opened them 7 or 8 weeks later, and for 2 weeks, did 2 more greens, same process, reopened them 8 or 9 weeks later in September. The golf course never had a hole that was completely closed. They had 2 temporary greens at a time. We got 4 greens regrassed this year. We'll probably do 4 more next year and 2 the year after that, and we will have transitioned to a more modern grass that we think will work better on those greens. As we did it, we did pull those greens. We didn't change any of the contours on any of those greens. We did, you know, greens over time tend to shrink, and we did push them out to their original dimensions, and one case perhaps a little bit past its original dimension, but it was an inexpensive but effective approach. That golf course, even with this going on, is going to have somewhere between 8 to 10% up on rounds this year and is 10% up on revenue this year, even though we regressed four of the greens during the year. So that's another approach. It's kind of painful because it's slow. And when that course is done, we may move on to another course. And we've had a lot of internal discussions, and I don't know what the answer is. We have another 18-hole golf course, Webb Memorial Golf Course, that has some of the smallest greens known to man. And, you know, when you're running 50,000 rounds over greens with an average, they're an average of about 2,100 square feet per putting green. It's really tough. And they also have this this goose grass that's becoming herbicide resistant going after them. The internal debate is very interesting. Besides, do we close the course down and redo it? Do we close 9 holes down and keep the other 9 open and redo 9 for 1-9 and then the other 9? Or do we pick off of them 1 hole at a time and do it over, you know, 8 or 10 years? I don't know. I do know that on the small project side, I can keep it under my control. I don't need to do, if we're redoing, we largely redid that in-house. If I'm rebuilding an entire green, we'll probably have to go outside and bring someone else in to do it. So it will become a bigger project. But I have found in my experience in the government agency, and I have said this in a meeting with all of the other department directors, I will do it through my department entirely if I can on my own and not involve anybody else, because then I can set the timeline and I can get what I want down on the timeline I want done. If I want to do a big project, our agency has a planning and engineering department. And if I want to do an RFP for a large construction project, I need to get my planning and engineering people in. And, you know, we have to have a meeting, and at the meeting, we'll schedule a meeting on site. And at that meeting, then we'll schedule another meeting to start talking about RFP and, you know, timeline creep. Yeah. Things take longer. So I know it's interesting. We'll see how that goes. I'm not sure how it'll play out yet.
Well, we look forward. You have to post that on your Instagram. We'll have to figure out what you decide. So hopefully there's some good different perspectives and approaches for those of you in the room. I want to move on to competitive pressures. And what I mean when I chose this was, you know, this municipal golf courses have a unique challenge in that we've talked about a lot already today about being accessible, right? And your price went up by $2, but it's still reasonably priced. How do you continue to deliver these higher level experiences at a municipal property that consumers are looking for and asking for? With technology, we haven't even touched on technology, but we just can't come out of hosting our technology conference in Las Vegas. That's a big area of investment right now for golf course operators, right? So how do you balance that? It seems to me there'd be sort of competing pressures, and there's an intersection where you can't maybe deliver championship golf at a price that your community residents, you know, view as affordable. So what are your thoughts on that? How are you doing it today? And what are your thoughts for the future?
Well, I think that you're always trying to create value, knowing that you're not going to win over everyone, and you know the individuals that have been playing Papago for decades, as I said, that we've been fortunate. That's been a Valley favorite for so long, and people have enjoyed the layout. It's a championship golf course that's meant to be challenging. And if you were a good player, you wanted to hang out at Papago and be a part of that. But it never really had the other amenities beyond that. So it had a small little snack bar, and the original golf shop was just this round building that wasn't necessarily very functional. It was, you know, a muni golf course. And so our concept or idea was to continue to create, have this municipal golf course, but dress it up some. And because I think a lot of people have an idea of what muni golf looks like, tastes like, smells like, costs like, what service levels are out there. And in my world, and having grown up in the Valley, it's always been a little bit of less than. And we always felt like we could be more. Papago sits in the center of the city. It's got an incredible setting with the buttes around it. And if we could put together a clubhouse that could showcase the setting and the golf course and the downtown area, along with having it being tied with ASU, it's you have an affluent area that's close by to buy in, close to South Scottsdale, the Tempe area. So we felt like we could create something that would bring value. And we've seen certainly our constituents that have played the golf course on and off for years and years and years and years, that they see that what's been done, and they see that their rates have gone up, but they see that where those that there's still a tremendous value of what Papago is to them and in the community, making the product better all the time. And we compete with all the other 150 other golf courses that are in the Valley as well. And we want to take advantage of, whereas a place in North Scottsdale might be charging 300 in season, we could be charging 150 and give them something that looks very similar and still have a competitive rate of $60 for that individual that lives and has been playing golf at Papago forever.
And for us, we're a little bit unique. We're fortunate to sit right in our downtown. So we definitely leverage our Park Avenue, which is our main street, as an aspect of the course. So people can go and have breakfast, play the course, go have lunch. So we leverage that. But for us, it's also all about creating an experience on the course and create an experience in some. We have two different logos. We have the Winter Park 9 logo. We also have the Winter Park Golf Course logo. That some of the older folks, it's a more traditional logo. So we kind of co-brand the course. People love the $2 beer. We still have $2 beer. You can get $4 beer there too. There's now, we have imports. So we've kind of created a little something for everybody. We want, there's an old saying in politics, if someone may write you a $5,000 check for your campaign, they may not show up to vote, because that's, for some people, that's pocket change. Somebody writes you a $50 check, they're going to show up and vote for you. And so it's the same thing with the course. We want interaction. We want people interacting with the course as much as they can. We have an 18-hole putting course right there, right next to it. So you go by any time of the day, morning, noon, and night, and people are out there just putting. They may not even play golf, but they go out there, they take their kids out there, and they interact with the course. We have movie nights, so people will come out and interact with the course in that way. When we sprigged the course, the community came out and sprigged the course. It wasn't just the shapers. When we have divot, we fill in divots and we get people to sponsor the holes, and they'll do cocktails on a hole and they'll fill the divots on that hole in one night. So we want interaction with the course that may or may not necessarily be golf related, because you start to take ownership, you start to think about your course. We're not cheap golf. We're good golf at a reasonable price, and it's their home course. People feel a sense of pride in the course. And again, a lot of it's got nothing to do with golf. It's just interacting with the course. So use those ambassadors, get people to your course, whatever you need to do.
I think those are all really great best practices that people in the audience can take back and implement in your communities and with your golf courses. Michael, as a last closing thought, sort of on balancing the needs we've talked about with stakeholders and community residents at the golf courses that you operate, is there anything that you'd like to share that's worked well for you?
We do get a lot of customer feedback. We have a citizens advisory committee that meets quarterly. We also send out thank you for playing emails with a survey in them to everyone who has an email in our system. And, the 1 out of 10 where someone responds back and says, thanks, everything's going great, is really nice, because most of the people that want to fill out your survey are the people that didn't like something. But that's okay. We have, we try to interact as much as we can with our customers. We've tried, when I went to Breck in 2014, they had 7 golf courses, and we now have 5. We closed 2. We had 2 that were unremarkable. I, in my opinion, it's an improvement to the entire public golf realm that those two golf courses are no longer in existence. No one will be suffering through playing with them. They were flat. They were designed, I think, by a local farmer or something. They had no drainage. They were a nightmare every time it rained, and it rains a lot normally in South Louisiana. You know, one of them lost 100 to 150 to 200,000 every year. The other lost 300,000 to 500,000 every year. And it's a huge, you know, just looking at the numbers, in 2014, when I went to Breck, they had seven golf courses and generated $3.5 million in revenue. We now have five golf courses, three 18s and two 9-hole courses. This year, we're on pace to do $5.3 million in revenue. But the message that I had when I came is that if we were a restaurant, we weren't cooking good enough food. And it wasn't smiling at them in the golf shop. It was improving our course conditions. And we spent, now I've been there 9+ years. We spent the first six of those really focusing on course conditions. And I remember, I liked when one of the architects said something about not worrying when someone complained about a bunker. That was great. Our citizens advisory committee, I'd been there about 2 years, and we have these quarterly meetings, and there was a guy that complained about the bunkers at one of the golf courses. And, you know, I'm a director of golf. I have two assistant directors. One of my assistant directors is a golf course superintendent who's been at it for like 40 years, and he's really good. And he said, bunkers. He said, how were the greens? The guy said, they were good. How were the fairways? They were good. How about the tees? Yeah, they were good. The driving range? Yeah, I like that too. But the bunkers were a problem. And he said, yep. And he turned to me and he wanted to shake my hand. He said, you know, that's what we were trying to do 5 years ago. He said, if we get to the point where all they have to complain about is the bunkers, I think we've made a big stretch, but we're getting there. Just one thought. And since I think we're getting near the end, are we getting near the end? My closing thought is my 2-minute speech. My kind of elevator speech on what we do with golf at Breck and Baton Rouge. Our mission statement, we talk about making golf in Baton Rouge better by providing great quality golf experiences. The real focus is on experiences, because we like to think we're in the golf business, but I work with people who run a zoo and they think they're in the zoo business. And I also work with a bunch of parks people that think they're in the recreation business. But every day people get up and decide what they want to do. Where do they want to go to eat? Do they want to play tennis? Do they want to play golf? Do they want to go to a zoo? We're really in the experience business. We're competing with all these other experiences every day. And our job is to give the best experience we can.
Yeah, 100% agree with both of those sentiments. Creating an experience, I think about at Papago what we want to do, and we want to invite people. We want to give them a reason to come out to the golf course. So that product, the clubhouse, the opportunity for families to bring their kids to run around and let the kids run around where they enjoy a glass of wine and watch the sunset. We want to greet these individuals. We want to engage them. And then we just want to serve them. And we all want everyone that comes to any of our facilities to, when they leave, to believe that they made the right choice that day. Because I know for a fact, and where I am, they could have gone to 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 different places to play golf, or have lunch, or get a glass of wine. But for that day, for whatever reason, they came to Papago. And it's our responsibility as an operator, as a team member, to make sure that individual believes that they made the right choice, and to be able to tell other people about that experience that they had.
Thanks again to Rachel, Steve, Michael, and Daryl for their time and sharing their expertise. Stay tuned for more episodes of the National Links Trust podcast featuring discussions from the symposium.